Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Republican leadership and Congress are frustrated and baffled by recent remarks by President Trump during a press conference in Helsinki with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
I do feel that we have both made some mistakes. I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all.
Trump appeared to side with Russia against his own intelligence operations, and that stance has elicited calls of treason from Democrats and other bipartisan criticism. He changed the wording of some of his statements a day later. We're talking about all of that and more with political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
Trump has this contentious meeting with members of NATO before he heads to Helsinki. He claimed it went great. And then in the midst of all of this, the claims that Russia meddled in the 2016 presidential election, he boasts about his meeting with Russia, too. How did he get to this point in foreign relations?
Well, I mean, from the beginning, Donald Trump has been his own Secretary of State, his own Secretary of Defense, his own National Security Advisor. So despite whatever recommendations and suggestions and advice he's been getting from the members of his cabinet and members of his administration, he still thinks he knows best. And so what's remarkable about this week is that it's not remarkable at all in the sense that we kind of knew that he would go to NATO and berate American allies and criticize, you know, foreign leaders, and then go to Helsinki and be BFF with Vladimir Putin. That's exactly what happened. He has this penchant or something for authoritarian leaders, be it in Russia or North Korea or Turkey or the Philippines or anywhere. And yet he'll talk about Theresa May, how she was awful during the Brexit negotiations. Mm-hmm. Well, he'll talk about Germany, how terrible they were with their trying to have this natural gas deal with Russia that put him in Moscow's pocket. He'll criticize Trudeau in the G7 meeting about, you know, what his complaints were about tariffs. He just seems to have this way of just criticizing people who are close to the United States and embracing more authoritarian figures.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment for Ken, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We do have a technical difficulty right now. We're trying to iron it out. So if you want to give us a call and tell us what you think about President Trump's statements at Helsinki, his follow-up statements, you know, apparently to change the word from wouldn't to would, or vice versa, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at wosu.org. Ken, are you still there?
I'm here. Okay. I've never left.
Okay. We do have a technical difficulty, but we'll try to get to it. He's gone back and forth with his statements about Russia. And you just yesterday he said he didn't believe Russia was targeting the United States.
What's going on?
What kind of impact does the president's actions have on the Republican Party and his administration? Because they're in as much of a tailspin as anybody is. Okay. We're working on our situation. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can, if you have a question or comment for Ken Rudin. We're trying to get Ken back on the line. We are going to be talking about President Trump today. We're going to talk about the Democrats in Congress who are working on, they're supposed to announce today a new caucus to address single-payer or Medicare for All. Tell us what you think about that, 614-292-8513. Hi, Ken. Are you back?
And I never left.
I know, but you sounded weird, Ken.
You know, when the gerbils don't work through the machine, somehow you just have to, everything sounds fine now.
Okay. All right. So you said he has a way of criticizing people that are friends with the U.S. and embracing those that are considered enemies or contrary to the values and the American values that we hold dear, sort of. What do you make of that, though? What is, do you think that there's a strategy involved here?
Well, you know, using the word strategy and Donald Trump in the same sentence is always a risky proposition. But I think the strategy seems to be is that he likes to be in control. He likes to be in charge. He likes to be the guy. And he does like the way that Vladimir Putin, for example, will deal with the Russian press. And he wishes he could do the same thing. He likes the way that Vladimir Putin deals with foreign adversaries. And he wishes he could do the same thing as well. So as I said earlier, he did this when he was in private business. He made all the decisions. He made all the financial decisions as well, and he feels that that's the way it should be. Now, unfortunately, this has been from day one. I mean, even before he came into office, when he was told by Obama intelligence officials that Russia absolutely played a role in meddling in the 2016 elections, he kind of like poo-pooed it. He said, well, I don't know about that. But even his own intelligence people, like Gina Haspel, the head of the CIA, and Dan Coats, the director of National Intelligence, have said the same thing, that Putin has absolutely played a role in meddling in the 2016 election. They are still planning to do it for 2018, and goodness knows what's going to happen in 2020. And yet his, as we saw in Helsinki, the fact that he is more willing, or seemingly more willing, to take Putin's word than his own national intelligence officials' word is just very troubling.
It still appears that this hasn't affected the ardor of his base. But I'm wondering, is there any fallout for Republicans writ large?
Well, you know, something, that's a good question. There seems to be a little space between his base, which, of course, as Donald Trump famously said in 2015, he can walk down the streets of Fifth Avenue in New York, shoot somebody, and his supporters will stay with him as much as ever. And that seems to be true. Mm-hmm. But we are hearing more criticism from members of Congress who have heretofore been very reluctant to criticize them. More reaction from members of Congress who seem to be much more disturbed, much more uneasy about the kind of things they've heard out of Helsinki. So there is some pushback. But then again, Tuesday, when the president seemed to make this cockamamie edit saying that I said would, but I meant to say wouldn't, and suddenly everything was okay. And then so many members of Congress, like Lindsey Graham, like Bob Corker, like other Republicans, said, well, all is forgiven. And yet there are other people who say, oh, wait a second, nothing has changed at all.
Let's hear from James. James in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was watching your program, and every president inherits the foreign policy tactics and posture of the previous president, at least during the first couple of years of their presidency. And I think, you know, certainly Donald Trump, he's not a career politician. He's going to have to make his way here the first couple, two or three years to learn this. You know, I mean, Barack Obama had a great deal of trouble in his presidency with his foreign policy. Even Jimmy Carter, who was considered the worst foreign policy president of the modern day era, criticized Barack Obama's foreign policy. So, as I say, every president inherits the foreign policy of the previous president. And it takes them a couple of years. Even most career politicians take them a couple of years to
right.
To
but
get
what,
their
does,
own footing.
What does I and I hear what you're saying, but what does Barack Obama's foreign policy have to do with what President Trump said in Helsinki on Monday?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. I mean, he inherited every president
Yeah, I know. You've said that. I get that, that every president inherits their predecessor's foreign policy. They inherit their predecessor's economic, you know, circumstances. They inherit all kinds of stuff. But what particular about his embracing of Russia and Vladimir Putin and other strongman leaders around the world versus the likes of Theresa May and Angela Merkel in Germany and so on in these you know, strong democracies? What about President Barack Obama leads to that, James?
Well, I'm just saying they inherited a foreign policy structure that was completely, it was bad. It was really, really bad. And he's not a professional politician.
Right.
He's not smooth enough to be able to handle this. It's going to take him a while to do this. I don't think he's, you know, certainly his comments in Helsinki were wrong. And he's made a lot of mistakes with foreign policy, I think, since he got in office. But, you know, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt because he's not a professional politician. And I think it's a little early in his presidency yet to be doing that.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, James. Ken Rudin, what do you think?
Well, you know something, I think he's giving President Trump too much of the benefit of the doubt. I mean, I remember when President Kennedy met with Soviet Premier Khrushchev in Vienna in early 1961, early in his presidency, and people could say, well, you know, he was young and experienced and taken advantage of, and he was. I mean, basically, Khrushchev wiped the floor with Kennedy in Vienna in 1961. And, of course, within a few months, the Berlin Wall went up, and the next year was the Cuban Missile Crisis. So sometimes you can say, well, you know, he's inexperienced. Well, you don't – I mean, this is the danger of electing somebody who's inexperienced with foreign affairs, and they can be taken advantage of. The fact is, though, that whenever you want to talk about Obama's foreign policy, and there is a lot to criticize with foreign policy, everything from Syria to North Korea to so many things, but the point is that by all accounts, by Obama's national security advisors and by Trump's national security advisors, Russia and Putin basically are doing everything they can to undermine American democracy and American free elections, and Trump does not seem to you can't just say, well, he's inexperienced, he's not a professional. The fact is that there's a cyber attack on the United States by Russia, by all accounts it's by Russia. And if the U.S. government doesn't take this seriously, this is dangerous for the future of democracy. I don't mean to sound dramatic, but it's absolutely true that we are under assault.
Well, as the details come out about what they the revelations of the investigation come out, it's pretty fascinating. And I want to talk about that as well. But first, James, thanks a lot for that call. I want to turn to Pat in Columbus with an alternative viewpoint from James. Hi, Pat.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I agree with Ken completely. This man has gone from being an embarrassment to this country to being a true danger to democracy. His naivete is unbelievable. And yes, he may be inexperienced, but he doesn't even accept the advice of his advisors. He's a very dangerous person for this country.
Pat, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, and you've made it as well, Ken, that it's one thing to be inexperienced. It's another thing to not turn then to the people you hired to do those jobs.
Is that a question directed at me?
Yeah.
Well, no, that's exactly the point. I mean, the point is that, I mean, look, George W. Bush didn't have foreign policy experience. He was the governor of Texas. Mm-hmm. So he picked Dick Cheney, who did have a history of that. I mean, that's why you have a cabinet. That's why you have a national security and national intelligence apparatus. To even if you're not experienced as president, you have sage advice. If you don't take the advice, if you think that you know better than your own cabinet, your own administration, then what's the point?
We are going to continue our conversation with Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll get to your calls. Keep them coming. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking politics with the political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We've been talking about the president and blowback after his statements in Helsinki and more blowback after his change of heart or his change of wording on Tuesday. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Ken, what did you make of the repair job he did on Tuesday, saying it was, he meant to say wouldn't versus would?
You know something? I mean, you know, this is not funny. And I just realized I admitted a little laugh here, but it's not funny at all. The fact is that if you listen, I've listened to that surreal press conference many, many times, but even just forget about the putting in the wooden for the wood, listen to everything else he said. Mm-hmm. He still was asked about who he would support between Putin and his intelligence agencies. He gave basically a Charlottesville answer there's goodness on both sides. Both sides have a good point. I really took him at his word. He guaranteed, and this is the scary part about having the president and Putin in a room with two translators and nobody else. I mean, even you know, it's funny. I was listening to some analysts in Moscow explain that there was some work, you know, some success and advancement on Syria policy, on nuclear weapons policy. And if you ask American intelligence officials, American State Department officials, they have no idea what went on because there's no record. And Trump has not explained to anybody. So that's what the most remarkable thing is.
Fauzi in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Fauzi. Hello, Fauzi. Okay, well, we don't have Fauzi. Let's see. Let's turn to Evan and Hilliard. Hi, Evan. You're on the air.
Hello. This is Evan. I have to admit that I'm very disappointed in the left nowadays. Whatever happened to the WMDs in Iraq and how just horrifically our intelligence community has been lying to us for the past numerous decades? Trump probably retracted his statement about, you know, I don't think they're whatever the heck the thing was, wood to wooden. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the intelligence agency that likely killed JFK and have been causing chaos all around America for a long time with the foreign policy dispute. I mean, all of this hacking of the election was done under Obama. Why didn't Obama do anything about it? That was his job. He was the executive. Trump has been doing a great job. He's fighting. I mean, he's making peace in North Korea. And to say earlier, our guest said that he doesn't have a strategy. He beat Hillary Clinton. He's a billionaire, and I could go on for a long time about all of his. I mean, if he doesn't have a strategy, good God, is he good at ad libbing?
Ken Rudin.
Oh my! I mean, that's like saying, you know, they're saying that the hacking went on under Obama, so therefore we should blame Obama. Well, you know, 9/11 happened under Bush, so we should blame Bush. Not the people who launched airplanes into the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. I mean, that's just crazy. The fact is that the Obama and the administration and the intelligence agencies did warn about Russian hacking and interference in 2016. But I think the feeling was that Obama felt that if he went public with it, Trump could turn around and say they're trying to rig the election, because that's what Trump said throughout 2016. This election is rigged. Now, he said it was rigged because he thought he would lose. As it turned out, he won. But to talk about, well, these are the people who killed JFK, well, then you may as well not believe anybody. I mean, you may as well not believe anybody in government and just believe Donald Trump. There's a cult of personality that's going on here that is just dangerous. And I suspect that 35 or 40% of the country, you know, believes it. Look, there's a lot of things that Donald Trump said during the campaign that did make sense. There's a lot of things during the 8 years of the Obama administration that was wrong. But to just suggest that you know, and I mean, Donald Trump is the only one. He goes to North Korea. He meets with Kim Jong-un for one day. And he says there's no longer a threat for nuclear war with North Korea when 6 months earlier we were talking about World War III. There's something Saturday Night Live or just a madness about it that anybody who just, you know, is paying any attention says this is not the, you know, this makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Let's see. Mike in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Yes. Okay. All right, good. Well, a lot of the callers have addressed some of the issues that I was initially going to raise, but the one thing that no one has made comment about is I watched Putin and Trump come on stage during that presentation, and when they did, Putin came on smiling. He hopped up on stage. Trump came out with the shoulder slumped down. He was defeated. There's no question about that body language. I've never seen Putin smile nearly as much as he did during that conference, especially at the beginning and end of the conference. So clearly, Putin got whatever it was that he wanted when they were behind closed doors. And for Trump to now say that he challenged Putin when they were behind closed doors in their private meeting, I mean, the guy is a pathetic, compulsive liar, and all he does is to say things that will make him look good, and that's what he's doing right now.
Well,
he is definitely not telling us the truth now, without a doubt.
What, I mean, Ken Rudin, just as a, you know, a veteran political journalist, how much do you read into body language at events like the Helsinki press conference?
Well, you know, of course, presidents can bluff, and I understand that, you know, body language does make a difference. Everybody talked about how Al Gore was always so stiff and George W. Bush was so relaxed, and it means something in some ways. But look, the point is that this is, we're beyond bluffing. We're beyond trying to just make a case by smiling a lot. The fact is that, you know, you have the rest of the administration. It's not that you know, he said one thing one day and another thing the other day. The fact is he has a history of saying good things about authoritarian figures. And I can give you, you know, tons and tons of examples like that about Putin. He just seems to like those who like him. And if he gets any kind of nice, any kind of compliment from any kind of a authoritarian figure, Look, obviously it reminded me a lot of Kennedy going into Vienna in 61 because he seemed unprepared. Donald Trump played golf for 2 days before the NATO conference. He played golf before the meeting with Putin. He just feels like he is Mr. Art of the Deal, and he's confident of his abilities. But this is, you know, with nuclear weapons and the future of the world peace at stake, you can't bluff, and I fear that so much of what happened in the days leading up to Helsinki and Helsinki itself, a lot of it was a bluff.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Let's go back to the Republican Party itself. Now that he changed from wooden to wood or wood to wooden or whatever it was, some Republicans, including notably the likes of Newt Gingrich, have said, oh, all right, you know, now I get what you're saying. It's maybe not such a terrible gaffe after all. But other Republicans remain concerned. We had a guy from Belmont County, a GOP leader, which, you know, I'm not sure the world stopped in shock, but he resigned his post with the Belmont County GOP in Ohio after the meeting in Russia. That's a pretty strong Trump territory.
Yeah, but you know something? I think there are more Newt Gingriches than there are about Belmont County Republican chairs. I really mean that seriously. I think those who are critical of Trump, those who have been suspicious of Trump from the beginning, will remain so. But I still think that the supporters of the president in the Republican Party, and polls show that he's extremely popular with not only the base, but with everybody in the Republican Party, the most popular Republican president in history, except for George W. Bush in the aftermath of 9/11. So while there are, you know, people like the Bob Cook, and the John McCain, who sent out a devastating statement. There are a lot of other Republicans who just couldn't believe what they, you know, was said. Even Fox News said this was a disgraceful performance. But for the most part, I think most of the Republicans are Newt Gingrich. They are the Lindsey Grahams who said, well, you know, now that he clarified this, I'm feeling much better. I think most Republicans fear, at least the ones in office, fear that they do not want to be the next Mark Sanford. They don't want to be the one who criticizes the president, then turns around and finds himself defeated in the primary election by disaffected Republicans. So there is a fear out there that you know, you criticize him at the expense of your own political future, and many of them are not willing to take that risk. And I know that frustrates a lot of people. Why don't Republicans stand up? Why doesn't Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan be stronger in their responses to Trump? And Mark Sanford is one of the reasons why.
Turning to congressional politics a little bit, there's this congressional race, 12th congressional district race to replace the seat left open by
T. Berry.
And it's a Republican-leading congressional district. It stretches from outer Columbus suburbs to rural Appalachia. It could be up for grabs, but the race isn't getting the attention that others have in illustrating that Democratic surge they were hoping for at the polls.
It's certainly one to watch. I haven't been giving the attention it probably deserves either. Look, I remember that district. That was John Kasich's old district. I go back, this is how old I am. I remember Sam Devine, who used to hold that seat. Ironically, the Republicans lost it in the Reagan year of 1980 when they won it back in the anti-Republican year of 82 with Kasich, to go figure. But it's something to watch. There have been surprises on both parties. Very few people saw the Mark Sanford defeat in South Carolina. Very few people saw the Conor Lamb victory, that conservative Democrat in Southwest Pennsylvania, in a district won by Trump by 20 percentage points. And then very few people saw Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the Bronx and Queens beat Joe Crowley. So there is anger out there. And of course, this is not a primary. This is a general election. But, you know, we watched this in 1974 when we weren't sure how much anger there was about Richard Nixon and Watergate. And we saw a lot of districts, including in Ohio, in Cincinnati, there was a big one in Cincinnati. I think the one that Tom Lucan won. And basically, we'll see what happens. If there is revulsion in swing districts to the Trump policies, to Republican policies, we'll see it in the 12th district. If not, then maybe all these liberal and Democratic pipe dreams of a Democratic resurgence in November may not happen. But this is the kind of district you want to watch to get some kind of clues for November.
And then meanwhile, House Democrats this week unveiled their midterm campaign slogan, For the People. And today, I guess Democrats are set to announce the formation of an official Medicare for All caucus. It's according to Vice. I don't know if others have reported it yet. Democrats aim further left as Republicans lean further right.
That's absolutely true. And again, you know, I mean, there are chasms in both parties, and we'll see what happens. I mean, that big battle in 2016 between the establishment led by Hillary Clinton and the progressive wing led by Bernie Sanders is still going on. And the question is, can you just say you don't like Trump? Can you just say I'm not a Republican and that's good enough for 2018, 2020? We don't know. But we do know that within the parties, both parties, there are ideological fights going on that may not even be resolved in 2018. I mean, we're talking about, you know, there was a New York Times article this week and talking about the Kamala Harrises and the Cory Bookers and the Elizabeth Warrens and the Joe Bidens who may be seeking the Democratic nomination in 2020. But until they seem to get the sense of what the Democratic Party is all about, I don't know who's going to be successful. The fact is that one size does not fit all when it comes to the party. You can be anti-Nancy Pelosi in one district and be, you know, a Democratic socialist in New York's 14th, as we saw with Ocasio-Cortez. So the parties are split. The parties are trying to figure it out. But but they're trying to come up with something. You can't just say, you know, you can't be Tom Steyer and just say, I want to impeach Donald Trump. You have to come up with something more than that, and voters are demanding it.
My guest is a political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Ken Rudin, we're talking politics this hour. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking politics this hour with Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment, email us at allsides@wosu.org. So going back to that, the House Democrats choosing that new slogan, for the people, what are they trying to convey, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think the American people are more sophisticated than just listen to slogans, but they are obviously trying to be a united front. They're, you know, they want to, I think, hide divisions within the party. You know, there are, even on the Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination, there are big divisions in the party over that. There are probably going to be more Democrats who are going to vote for Brett Kavanaugh to be a Supreme Court justice than there will be Republicans voting against him. So I think they somehow need to form, or at least present, a united front in time for the midterms, and maybe that's obviously part of what they're trying to do, but I'm not sure how it's working. By the way, not only am I a veteran political journalist, maybe a veterinarian, but I'm also, after this job, I'm going to get a job with Verizon and work for the phone company and fix this thing for once and for all, because, you know...
Yeah. Well, yeah, I thank you from the bottom of my heart if you can achieve that goal. Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio has attracted some not great attention in recent days. He's denied knowledge of sexual abuse allegations tied to the late Dr. Richard Strauss at Ohio State, where Jim Jordan was an assistant wrestling coach for several years. He's done pretty well in maintaining his stance on this, and it doesn't seem to have hurt him politically, but I'm wondering, do you think it hurts him on the campaign trail when he's out there trying to help his colleagues?
Well, yes. I mean, that's a very good point. It may not affect his re-election. He seems to win very handily each time he's run for re-election. But, of course, at the same time, his name is up there as a possible successor to Speaker Paul Ryan. I mean, there's Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader, Steve Scalise of the Louisiana Majority Whip. I mean, those names are out there. And so is Jim Jordan, who's very popular with the Freedom Caucus and other conservatives. But the fact that this is hanging over him, he denies it, and that's fine. And there are a lot of members of Congress are defending him, saying this obviously couldn't have happened. But here's the thing. I mean, I'm not trying to equate anything here, but you also have a White House that just hired Bill Shine, the former Fox News executive, who was forced out because of the Fox News' record regarding sexual allegations, sexual harassment against women. Mm-hmm. So if you have, and I mean, Bill Shine, that's exactly why he was pushed out, because of his inability to, you know, deal with this problem. If the White House is going to hire Bill Shine as a major person in the administration, given all the criticism about him, then maybe nothing should matter about Jim Jordan either. Like, I'm not saying that the accusations against Jim Jordan are true. I'm just saying that there are serious accusations out there, and there are serious problems regarding the treatment of women and treatment of children, and it seems like that it's happening too much. Too many politicians are involved, and it seems like when people in power make these kind of important decisions, they really just, you know, seem to take expediency over common sense. But anyway, what I'm saying is, though, that Jim Jordan, as a national leader, as somebody who can go from place to place to place to spread the Freedom Caucus doctrine, I think that is hurt. I don't think it affects him in November, but nationally, I think it does.
I wanted to talk about the media for a few minutes, Ken. You know, I watch the press, you know, briefings with the president's press secretary and on a regular basis, and they just seem to be getting more and more and more combative. And I've certainly seen combative ones in the past, but this is a constant barrage of, you know, slights back and forth. What do you make of it?
I hate it. I mean, I absolutely hate it. Look, it's easy to, do I think the press goes too far? Look, you know, immediately within seconds of the president's press conference in Helsinki, Anderson Cooper went on CNN and said, this was the most disgusting thing I've ever seen in my life. And I kind of winced at that. I think that it may be disgusting and it may be surreal, but I don't know if Anderson Cooper's the guy who needs to tell me that. Maybe he should have a guest on a show who tells me that. But at the same time, when you have the president of the United States saying, you know, and overseas with the whole world watching, I'm not going to take a question from Jim Acosta of CNN, but CNN is fake news, and I'm going to go to the real news people, and he went to John Roberts of Fox News. John Roberts could have said, you know, I'm sorry, Mr. President, but we're all in this together. We're all journalists. Instead, he got his question, and everybody was fine. I don't think... The question isn't who started it. The question is, it's awful. The relationship is awful. Do I think the president is at fault? I do. Do I think that the media firing back with obvious contempt is wrong? I do. It's, you know, I remember Nixon and battling Dan Rather at one press conference where they were snarling back and forth. This is the worst I've ever seen it.
That's what I wanted to know, if it's the worst.
It's the worst.
And what does that mean to the reporting? I mean, doesn't that just contribute to the lack of faith in the media anyway? Which, trust, I mean, you know this as well as I do. It didn't start with Donald Trump.
No, it didn't. No, it didn't. And I mean, you know, no, you're absolutely right. But it feeds into Trump's narrative that this is fake news, that the press is the enemy of the American people. If they see, you know, I mean, look, I don't know. I'm not in the White House press room, but when Sarah Sanders says something that's so outrageous and so obviously not true, you know, sometimes you want to wish that all the journalists would just walk out and say, why am I covering this stuff when it's not true? But again, that would feed into the Trump narrative that they're all biased and they're fake and they're lying. And so if nothing else, Trump wins in the sense that the American people can see that there's discontent on both sides, and why should we believe the press? Why should we believe the mainstream media if they're going to show their obvious contempt for the president? And of course, if you're a journalist, I mean, how could you sit there and take it from the president day in and day out saying, you're a liar, you're a liar, you're a liar? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just ugly, and it's not what a lot of us signed up for, that's for sure. And that's like saying if I'm going to a press conference and Trump calls on me and he calls me a veteran political journalist, I would be furious. I would be livid.
That's the only time I said that the whole. But I was wondering if you'd notice. I'm just starting to see if you're listening to me or not, or if you're just, you know, making stuff up. So what are you looking for? Here we are in the, you know, approaching the end of the summer. We'll have one more chat before the Labor Day weekend, which is sort of the official kickoff of the backbreaking portion of the election cycle. But what are you looking at right now nationally?
Well, obviously, the big story in Washington is the Kavanaugh nomination. And, you know, I mean, it's one thing to exchange Antonin Scalia for Judge Neil Gorsuch, because it's almost like a gimme, you know, an even swap, a conservative for conservative. And even though Anthony Kennedy was considered the swing justice because he supported same-sex marriage and affirmative action and abortion rights. Replacing him with Brett Kavanaugh is almost, you know, almost an even swap as well. But I'm watching the pressures on these Sundays. There are 10 Democrats seeking re-election this year in the Senate in states won by Donald Trump. And some of them I don't think are really threatened, like Sherrod Brown. I don't think he's really, really threatened. Bob Casey in Pennsylvania, I don't think he's threatened either. Mm-hmm. But the Heidi Heitkamps in North Dakota, the Joe Donnellys in Indiana, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, even Claire McCaskill in Missouri, these Democrats are under tremendous pressure, not only to vote for Brett Kavanaugh, but to have an open mind when it comes to Trump policies, because there are a lot of Trump voters in their state. So for all the talk about Susan Collins being a moderate on abortion, and she could, you know, she could be, you know, persuaded to vote against Brett Kavanaugh, which I don't think she will, there is tremendous pressure on these Democrats in the Senate to either vote with their constituents or vote their conscience. And that is going to be that's going to be a big battle if the Democrats are going to have any shot of winning the Senate in November.
Are you confident that the confirmation process will come off with relatively without, you know, much of a hitch?
Well, here's what I think. I mean, we saw this with Neil Gorsuch last year that basically, and this is not just a Republican thing. Democratic nominees do this too. They have a way of just not saying anything. They all learned the lesson of Robert Bork in 1987, and when Bork told everybody exactly how he felt about everything, and the Democrats said, whoa, this guy is crazy, and we're going to vote him down, and they did vote him down. I will give the Democrats something about the Robert Bork nomination. As much as they didn't like him, they still gave him hearings, they still voted, had a vote on the nomination, and they voted him down. That's much more than Merrick Garland got in 2017, when not only did he not get a vote, he didn't even get a hearing. I don't blame Trump for that. I do blame McConnell and the Senate Republicans for that. I think there was a disgraceful lack of civility and decency that I think just, you know, continues the problem that we're having with the two parties not trusting each other. But as far as Kavanaugh goes, I think it's going to be probably, unless some amazing thing from the past comes up. But remember, he was confirmed in 2006. And I don't think anything has happened that would change the equation since then. But what does scare me, though, is that you wonder about Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Stephen Breyer or other older liberal judges on the Supreme Court, and if they leave the court for any reason. I mean, I know people who are talking about, you know, donating body parts to Ruth Bader Ginsburg to make sure she lives forever. I say that, you know, with a little dark humor, but. But, you know, if a liberal leaves the court, and then you have an Amy Coney Barrett as somebody who replaced him or her, that will change the court for generations to come. And I'm not saying that that's good or bad. I'm just saying that if you're a liberal, that's your worst fear. If you're a conservative, that's your greatest hope.
You know, something former Minnesota Senator Franken tweeted out, and he's not reached out much to the public in, you know, recent months since he resigned amid the controversy about some of his actions from many years ago during the Me Too movement. But be that as it may, he recently questioned and put forth a series of questions he would ask the nominee for the Supreme Court, Kavanaugh, if he were in the Senate, and hopes that others would, and that would be why he came out and said during his introductory press conference at the nomination point that no one had ever put so much thought and time into this as Donald Trump. And, you know, I wonder what you think about that and about that comment. A, why would he know? B, why would he? It's not true. And C, what do you think about it, what it says about him?
You know, actually, I'm surprised you mentioned that, because I thought I was the only one who caught that. When I heard Brett Kavanaugh say that Trump has put more focus and effort into this deliberation than any president in history, I said, well, these things are always secret. These things are always private. These things are not public. For Brett Kavanaugh to say this is just pretty remarkable. The fact remains, of course, is that the Federalist Society and other conservative groups basically did what they were supposed to do. They came up with a list of conservatives for Republican presidents to choose among. And the reason they did that is because they didn't want another David Souter. They didn't want, remember, when the first President Bush named a Supreme Court nominee, they picked David Souter, a justice from New Hampshire. And he turned out to be a liberal. And John Sununu swore by him, and the Republicans in New Hampshire swore by him. And he turned out to be a pro-choice liberal, and the conservatives went ballistic. And then when President George W. Bush was attempting to put Harriet Myers on the Supreme Court, conservatives said, this can't be happening. This is crazy. So for all those who criticize the Federalist Society and conservatives who are coming up with these lists, boy, if I were a conservative activist, that's exactly the kind of list I would want to see, because I don't want any more Souters or Harriet Myers. So look, I don't know what role Trump played. I do know that during the campaign, he promised that he would name judges who would overturn Roe versus Wade. Mike Pence said the same thing. So for him to say, I have no idea how Brett Kavanaugh would rule on abortion, I think that's a little bit disingenuous. But as far as Trump's role in the deliberations and the search, I think that was a little bit overstated by Brett Kavanaugh.
Okay, we have a quick call to turn back to the 12th Congressional District. Iris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Iris.
Hi. You were talking earlier about the special election in the 12th District.
Yep.
And we were talking also about the party identification, like with being more progressive versus pragmatic. And I don't know if Mr. Rudin has seen any of Daniel Connor's ads on TV, but he says that in the ads. You know, he says, I'm going to be pragmatic. And I think it's like an example maybe of like Mr. Rudin said earlier with Connor Lamb running in Pennsylvania, how they're gearing their message to specifically the district that they're running in.
Hmm. Ken Rudin?
She's absolutely correct. I mean, Daniel Connor is running exactly what you want to run in a swing, leaning Republican district. You don't want to be, you know, you don't want to be what happened in the Bronx and Queens with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was saying that, you know, I want in the Bronx to be annexed by the Soviet Union. I mean, of course, she didn't say that. Mm-hmm. But you want to say things that, I mean, there are a lot of, Nancy Pelosi is not the most popular Democrat in the Midwest and the rural, you know, the industrial Midwest. So what works in the Bronx, what works in Berkeley, California, may not work in Columbus, Ohio. So I think what he's doing is smart. I think he's running as many of the Democrats who are running in these kind of purplish, reddish districts are doing the smart thing. They have to be less about ideology and more about constituent service. And again, if O'Connor wins the special, I think it'll be one of those things that send, as many of the special elections have happened in the age of Trump, that if a Democrat picks up a historically Republican district, it sends a signal for November, whether it means a national wave or not, but everybody's going to be watching the results.
Iris, thanks for that call. And Ken Rudin, as always, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
I had nothing better to do, so it was great. And, you know, I mean, it's nice being, you know, working on the phones and, yeah.
We'll get it all worked out, you know, just, okay.
and, you know, I love being on all sides, as you know. I always have for all my years of being a veteran
political journalist.
Yeah, thank you so much, Randy.
Ken Rudin. Longtime political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Thanks again. And thanks to everybody for your patience today. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.